Thank you very much. And let me just reiterate what others have said to thank Professor Claudine Tiercelin, both for organizing a wonderful conference, intellectually stimulating, but also to Claudine and also Sophie here, Sophie Concil-Rodriguez, and the sound bearers as well, for being such wonderful hosts and treating us like royalty while we are here in Paris. The question that I'm going to address is essentially the very same one that Brad was addressing. The answer I'm going to give is a little bit different. I'll spend a little bit of time setting it up, even though you've seen it before. I'm going to set up the problem a little bit differently. So I think we can maybe go through this quickly. So by actual causation, I mean the kind of relationship that's described by statements like these. A meteor strike in the Yucatan caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. Sparks cast by a locomotive caused the fire that destroyed Jacob Anderson's house. That's an American lawsuit from the 1920s. The emission of X-rays from a charged vacuum tube in Röntgen's lab caused an image to appear on a screen, and so on. And this is a relation that's been of great interest to philosophers, but also to legal theorists, and particularly because it seems to be a causal notion that's involved in concepts of moral and legal responsibility, and also in the explanation of particular events, such as the extinction of the dinosaurs. And a standard view among philosophers, and I was talking with Morali a little bit before this, who said, what's all this talk about actual causation? What's all this stuff? And this is kind of a newfangled name. Philosophers used to talk about singular causation or token causation. And I think a standard line is that what's distinctive about this relationship is that they involve particular events. It's a particular meteor rather than meteor strikes in general. It's particular sparks cast by a particular locomotive at a particular time and place, and so on. And that the contrast is with causal generalizations, such as large meteor impacts cause extinction events or sparks cause fires, and so on. So that's kind of a standard picture of actual causation and what makes it different from other kinds of causal relations. I want to suggest that that's not the whole story, or maybe even the most important part of the story. And to suggest that another characteristic feature of actual causation is something that Michael was hinting at, namely the backward-looking nature of it as opposed to the forward-looking nature of it. And that questions of actual causation tend to arise when some event has occurred and we retrospectively ask why it occurred. So almost all the examples that are given of actual causation are almost always formulated in the past tense. You know, Susie's throw caused the bottle to shatter or caused the window to break or whatever it is those vandals are up to right now. So there's a well-known approach to causation, the counterfactual theory of causation due to David Lewis. And to a first approximation, I'm not going to go into the various epicycles of the theory, except for, I'll talk about some epicycles, but not Lewis's own epicycles. But to a first approximation, the idea is that C is a cause of E if the following counterfactual is true. If C hadn't occurred, E wouldn't have occurred. So if the meteor had not struck the Yucatan, maybe you want to say maybe if it had not struck the Earth, the dinosaurs would not have gone extinct, or at least would not have gone extinct then. They probably would have eventually. It's the fate of us all. And then a standard suite of problems that any type of counterfactual theory is going to face involving cases of preemption and overdetermination. Professor Tiercelin mentioned these briefly in her introduction, and several people have talked about these. So the standard example, Billy and Susie are standing with rocks in their hands, and Susie throws her rock at a window and it shatters. But it turns out if Susie hadn't thrown her rock, Billy would have thrown his rock at the window and it would have shattered anyway. So we say in this case that Susie preempted Billy. She got there first. She got the first blow in. And in this case, we want to say that Susie's throw caused the window to shatter. Maybe the rock shattered too, but the window to shatter. But the corresponding counterfactual is not true. It's not true that if Susie hadn't thrown her rock, the window wouldn't have shattered because Billy is there to back her up. So I'm going to introduce an approach to solving this problem, and it's one that's not, there's still some kinks to be worked out, but a kind of general strategy, and then I'm going to shift gears a little bit in almost exactly the same direction that Brad did. But I'm going to introduce you, I'm surprised this hasn't really come up, very brief introduction to structural equation models and how we can use them to represent the causal structure of a case like this or of a story like this, and importantly, in a way that captures the relevant counterfactuals. So the way we do this is we introduce variables that represent the events in the story. So for example, in my little story about Susie and Billy, we'll have a variable, the variable Susie throws, and we'll assign values to this variable. So for instance, the value 1 means that Susie does throw, and the value 0 means that Susie doesn't throw. If you like, you can think of this as being like truth values. Susie throws true or Susie throws false. And then we represent the pattern of dependence among the variables by equations. So Brad showed this. So I'll use abbreviations, but Susie is ready. She's there with the rock in her hand. Billy is ready. He is standing there with a rock in his hand. So those variables take the value 1 in this. Then we'll say Susie will throw just in case she's ready to throw, or just in case she's got her rock in her hand. So this is a slightly complicated. This is a Boolean and not, you can think of this. So Billy will throw just in case Billy is ready and Susie doesn't throw, right? So just in case BR takes the value 1, this will take the value 1 if BR takes the value 1 and ST takes the value 0. So that is, Billy will throw just in case Billy is ready with his rock and Susie doesn't throw. And then the window will shatter just in case either Susie throws or Billy throws. So the value of this will be the maximum of the value of this. So these are all Boolean, ordinary Boolean relations. Now the interesting feature of the distinctively causal element comes in the way that we represent counterfactuals. So there's a distinctive way we represent counterfactuals, and we do this by replacing the equation for the relevant variable. So we do not do what we do in algebra, namely substitute the value in, but rather we replace the equation wholesale. I should maybe go back and say, and this, again, sort of repeating what, the arrows here, all they mean is they're reflecting the qualitative structure of this system of equations, right? So this just means whether Susie throws depends directly on whether she's ready, whether Billy throws depends upon directly upon these two variables. Whether the window shatters is going to depend upon whether Susie is ready and Billy is ready, but not only indirectly, right? So given that Susie throws, it kind of doesn't matter whether she was ready if we somehow, quick, throw the rock. And she, you know, even if she wasn't ready, the window will break. Okay, so now to represent the counterfactual, if Susie had not thrown her rock, what we do is we're going to now replace this equation. So what we're going to now say is that Susie's throw doesn't depend upon whether she's ready anymore. We're just going to stipulate that Susie throws. So here was our original set of equations in our model, and we're replacing it with a new set of equations now in which we just set the value of that variable to zero. And this is very much like, if you're familiar with Lewis's idea of a minor miracle occurring, right? We imagine that Susie miraculously throws, even though the rock wasn't in her hand somehow. You know, the rock springs into her hand and she throws the rock. And in effect, this is changing the causal structure. So now Susie's throw doesn't depend upon whether she is ready anymore. So that changes the qualitative structure of the model as well. So there's a promising approach to defining actual causation that I've developed. I should mention Jim here has a version as well, and Halpern and Pearl have the kind of the most elaborate version. And it has similarities to other models that have been developed, including Lewis's own quasi-dependence model and the Nordhoff Ganeri Ramachandran model and so on. But I think it's easier to represent with this formal apparatus. And the idea is to look for what I'm going to call path-specific effects. So coming back to our model, the idea is that what's going on here, the reason that the window shatters whether Susie throws or not, intuitively it's because Susie's throw influences the shattering of the window by two separate causal routes, and this is made very salient by the diagram. She sort of sends her rock in flight towards the window, but she also signals to Billy not to throw, and that kind of what happens is these two different causal pathways cancel out, or result in her throw not making any difference. So what we want to do is isolate the influence of Susie's throw along just one of these paths and prevent the influence from traveling along the other path. And kind of metaphorically, what we're going to do is we're going to clamp the other path to sort of focus on this path. We're going to prevent any influence by traveling on this path by clamping this variable fixed. We're not going to allow this variable to move even when Susie throws. So we're going to wiggle whether or not Susie throws, but we're not going to let that wiggle continue up this path. So kind of visually there, we've got a clamp, and we're just going to clamp it. We're going to hold it fixed like that. And in the mathematical framework, what this means is that in addition to setting this value, this variable, to zero, so this is the counterfactual if Susie hadn't thrown, we're also going to set this variable to zero. So in fact, Billy didn't throw. And now, rather than letting Billy's throw depend upon Susie's throw, we're just going to fix that variable at the value zero. So we're now going to replace that equation and just substitute in the value zero. And in this new model, we do get the result that the window doesn't shatter. So the counterfactual we've just evaluated is, if Susie hadn't thrown her rock and Billy still didn't throw his rock, then the window wouldn't have shattered. And I think what's nice about this way of putting it is there's a kind of nice intuitive motivation that in some sense the counterfactual dependence is a function of these different causal pathways, and the judgment of actual causation is tracking one specific causal pathway. So you're kind of decomposing the counterfactual dependence but focusing on just one of those pathways of influence. So what I like about this approach is there's a kind of intuitive basis to it. But all the attempts to define actual causation end up being too liberal. That is, they generate instances of one thing being an actual cause of another that intuitively don't seem to be actual causes. So they seem to be too liberal. What I'm going to do now is, instead of trying to say, talk to you about attempts to fix this within the formal apparatus, to suggest thinking about this in exactly the way Brad suggested. So why do we have this conceptual tool? Why do we engage in a practice of identifying path-specific effects? Why do we go out of our way to point out path-specific effects? And the hope is that an answer to this question will motivate formal treatment, will give us, provide us clues as to how to restrict the set of path-specific effects that underwrite relations of actual causation. So, well, here's a hunch. I haven't worked out all the details, so in a way I'm floating a fairly new idea here. This part of the idea isn't new, and this one is more than a hunch. I'm pretty convinced by this. The idea that causal information tells us about handles in the world, it gives us information about how our interventions in the world can be used to produce desirable outcomes is an idea that's been around for a while. Jim Woodward has developed this idea in more detail than anybody else, but I think Hugh Price defends a version of this idea, and Nancy Cartwright in a paper from 1979 I think, was it Brad, mentioned that. And I think the idea is implicit in a lot of work, certainly in biomedical sciences. We're interested in discovering what causes what because we want to intervene on health outcomes. So I think that idea is certainly right. But I think the idea needs to be refined, and again, Brad laid out part of it. In decision theory, and I think now for those of you that are familiar with it, if you think of the Gibbard-Harper formulation of causal decision theory, we evaluate potential actions. So in decision theory, I am faced with a set of possible actions, and I have to choose which action to perform. And the way you do this, and this is most explicit in the Gibbard-Harper formulation, is you consider what would happen with various probabilities if I were to perform this action. What would happen if I were to perform this action? And then I see how desirable is the outcome of performing this action or that action. And this is similar to considering a counterfactual. It is future tense rather than past tense. So instead of saying, what would have happened if I had drank a second glass of wine at lunch instead of just one? How would my talk be different? You are asking the question in the future tense, what would happen if I were to do this right now, or if I were to do this later this afternoon? But in decision theory, we do not look at path-specific effects. Decision theory does not involve these multiple antecedent counterfactuals that isolate path-specific effects in causal model. To repeat the example I asked Brad about, suppose Susie wants above all else for the window to shatter. And her question is, should she throw the rock? So her choices are throw the rock, don't throw the rock. But she knows that Billy is backing her up, and she knows Billy will throw if she doesn't. So she reasons, if she throws the rock, the window will shatter. If she doesn't throw the rock, Billy will throw the rock and the window will shatter. So decision theory tells her that she should be indifferent between throwing and not throwing. Right, it doesn't matter. As long as the window shatters either way, it really doesn't matter what she does. So decision theory in its normal formulations, only considers counterfactuals involving the target variable or the potential causal variable. If Susie throws, if Susie doesn't throw, but there doesn't seem to, decision theory doesn't have Susie reason. So what happens if I throw, if I don't throw and Billy doesn't throw, even though he would? Right? That type of reasoning doesn't play any role in normal formulations of decision theory. So the question is, when would we be interested in that kind of reasoning? When would we need to think that way? And what I think is going on here is that decision theory in its normal formulations involves what we might call cause-forward reasoning. So the choice situation is one where you're faced with a range of possible actions, and then you evaluate those possible actions according to all of their downstream consequences. But there are other kinds of practical reasoning problems we face. And one kind of practical reasoning problem is one where instead of starting with the range of actions that are before me, think of the goal, the end state that I want to reach. And then I reason backwards from that goal. I think, okay, I want to be in Avignon tomorrow at noon. What do I have to do? Well, I'll have to take the TGV to get there. Oh, in order to take the TGV, I'll have to buy a ticket. In order to buy a ticket, I'll need to get on the internet. In order to get on the internet, I'll need to recharge my computer, and so on, right? So we reason backwards in a series of steps. And I'm going to call this a plan, right? A plan is going to be a sequence of actions that I'm going to perform designed to achieve some particular goal. So instead of just considering one choice situation, one node in a decision tree, and asking what am I going to do, I'm going to have a kind of sequential plan where there are going to be a series of steps. And this is a kind of effect backwards reasoning. So instead of looking at the potential cause or the current action that I'm going to perform and thinking about all of its possible effects, I'm going to start with the end state, the effect I want to achieve, and then reason backwards from there to possible means of getting there. But now, in this, when I'm engaged in this kind of reasoning, suppose now I'm at step one and I'm about to execute the first step of my plan. Now when I'm thinking about what action to perform at step one of my plan, I'm not thinking of the future as just, as it were, unfolding or being determined by my current action. I perform my action and then let the future unfold as it may. But rather, I'm thinking of parts of the future are going to be determined by my future actions, future steps in my plan. And I have to think about how my present action is going to work in conjunction with those future actions that I'm going to perform. So here's an illustration. It's an oversimplified version of a real life problem that gets faced. So here's the illustration. We're all members of the city council, and we want to make our city bicycle friendly. Maybe Paris, I think, is fairly bicycle friendly. I see these bicycles that you can have these like magnetic things that they stick to, and you can put in coins, I guess. But suppose we want to make our city bicycle friendly. We want to encourage people to ride bicycles, but we also want bicycle riders to be safe. And one of the things we're considering is whether to implement a mandatory helmet law, so whether to require that people wear helmets when they ride their bicycles. So this is our decision situation. And our goal is to decrease the proportion of accidents that result in serious head injuries. So we want to protect bicycle riders from head injuries. But we want to do this without increasing, we don't want to decrease the overall number of bicycle riders. That would be one way of decreasing the number of head injuries from bicycles. And we don't want to increase the total number of accidents, even if we somehow decrease the proportion of bicycle riders that get involved in accidents. So now let's consider what the causal model of our decision situation might look like. It's gonna be fairly complicated. The version I will give will be an oversimplification, but at least will give, I think, some sense of the complexity of this. So here's our variable helmet law. So are we gonna set this variable to 1 or 0? Or are we gonna implement the helmet law or not? Well, let's consider the effect of a helmet law on a typical rider who rides their bicycle. Who's a bicycle rider? Come on, volunteers. Okay, so what is your name?
Rafi.
Okay, so Rafi is our typical bicycle rider, and as members of the city council, we're gonna consider what the effect of passing this law on Rafi will be. So one question we might ask is, one choice he might make is say, oh, forget it, I'm not gonna ride a bicycle anymore if I have to wear a helmet, right? So whether we pass the law might influence his choice as to whether to ride the bicycle or not. If he does decide to ride a bicycle, he might just ignore the helmet law and ride without a helmet anyway. So we have to think, what will be the effect of passing the law on Rafi's actual behavior? And what are some other factors that might influence these things? Well, if we make our city bicycle friendly in other ways, this might encourage him to ride his bicycle. It's like, no, I don't want to ride my bicycle if I have to wear a helmet. Well, we'll throw in some bicycle lanes for you, sweeten the deal. Like, okay, maybe I'll ride my bicycle now, right? What I call CCC, this is short for cost, how much a bicycle helmet costs. You know, if it's too expensive, Rafi doesn't want to spend 50 euros on a bicycle helmet. Convenience. So if you have a bicycle helmet, you have to store it someplace. Maybe if you're going to a club or something and you don't want to be carrying around a helmet, you know, you're dancing on the dance floor. C in English is for coolness. I'm not sure how that translates. En français, c'est peut-être chic ou couture. Ouais. No. C'est pas très chic. Ouais. Okay, so, you know, I look silly in a bicycle helmet. I don't want to look silly, right? So all of these considerations can influence whether or not he wears a helmet. Whether he rides his bike will influence whether he gets in an accident, as we've said. If he doesn't ride his bicycle, he's not going to get in, well, he certainly won't get into a bicycle accident or the sort of accident we're particularly concerned to prevent. But of course, we can, whether or not the city is bicycle friendly in other ways will influence the likelihood of his being in an accident. Interestingly, the number of other bicycle riders has an influence on how likely it is that he will be in an accident. So the more bicycle riders there are, for instance, the more aware drivers in cars will be aware of bicycles. You know, in California, Southern California, where I live, you know, you come to a stop sign and maybe you go like this, but if there are lots of bicycle riders, I'll look like that, you know, make sure there isn't somebody in a bicycle coming by before I turn right. The helmet, whether we pass the helmet law, will influence not just Rafi's behavior, but will also influence other people's behavior, and that in turn will affect the likelihood that Rafi gets involved in an accident. And of course, these other things will also affect other people's decision whether to ride their bicycle. And then finally, whether or not Rafi suffers a head injury is going to depend upon whether he gets in an accident and whether he's wearing a helmet. And again, this is an oversimplification, but I think conveys the idea that this is a very complex problem and there's going to be a very complex causal structure we'll have to think about. And in particular, in this causal structure, there are multiple causal pathways whereby passing the helmet law will influence the chance of a head injury, of Raphim's head injury. So, let's see, get this right. So here are all the causal pathways in, even in this oversimplified causal structure of the roots that go from the helmet law to the head injury. So the question is, why might we focus on some of those roots and not others? Why are there some of these roots that are very salient or very important to our deliberations? Well, the reason is we're not in a situation where we just pass the helmet law or not and then sit back and watch the world unfold. We can make separate interventions, and in particular, we can make interventions to undo some of the undesired consequences of the law. So if the passing the helmet law has an effect of discouraging people to ride, we can try to do other things to encourage them to ride and counteract that influence, that undesirable influence. So this is our set of paths again. But we can do things to, as it were, undo these effects. So we can say, you know what, we're not going to let the helmet law reduce the number of riders, and we're not going to let the helmet law convince Rafi to stop riding the bicycle. We're going to offer other inducements or intervene in other ways to prevent this effect from occurring. And when we clamp those two routes, we're left with this one, the one from passing the helmet law to wearing a helmet to the head injury. So the causal pathway in which passing a helmet law will encourage Rafi to wear a helmet, and where his wearing a helmet will protect, in my hypothetical example, it was a woman, substitute Rafi in there, will protect his head in case of an accident. And if this particular path-specific effect isn't there, if that path-specific effect isn't there, either because the law just wouldn't persuade him to wear a helmet, or because bicycle helmets don't provide adequate head protection if you're involved in an accident, then the helmet law is completely pointless. That is, we can undo the other negative consequences of passing the helmet law, but if this particular causal pathway isn't present, right, if those particular steps are not instantiated, then we cannot produce the desirable effect we want to achieve. So there is a principled reason from among those many causal pathways to single out one as being of central importance to our deliberation, as one without which it's pointless passing the law. We can fix up some of the problems created by those other pathways, but if this pathway isn't there, or if it even goes in the other direction for some reason, maybe Rafi's the sort of person that would have been perfectly happy to wear a helmet until somebody tells him he has to, and then he refuses to do it. We probably all know people like that, especially if you're parents. Your kids are probably always like that. I let my hair grow very long when I was a teenager because I refused to cut it until my mother stopped telling me to cut it. And the suggestion is this kind of causal pathway that is going to be central to our deliberations in this kind of multi-intervention process is also the very same kind of pathway that is going to be salient when making claims about actual causation. So if Rafi rides his bicycle, gets in an accident, bangs his head on the ground, but does not suffer any serious injury, I would never do that to a member of my audience. That it's sort of that very same causal pathway that we would focus on if we were to decide, gee, was the helmet law a good thing? Did the helmet law actually prevent Rafi from suffering an accident. We would look very specifically at that causal pathway. We wouldn't worry about whether the helmet law maybe discouraged other bicycle riders or so on, but we would focus on that one pathway. And what the effect of this will be, and I'm going to leave this very qualitative, is that judgments of actual causation pick out causal paths that remain when other, and I'm going to run this together, feasible, desirable, expected interventions are performed. So whether or not we hold fixed a certain variable in evaluating a causal path is going to be kind of, I can use a French word, a mélange of these considerations. Do we want to intervene on that variable? Can we intervene on that variable? Do we expect to intervene on that variable? And this will have the effect that actual causation, what is an actual cause of what, will have a pragmatic dimension. It will depend upon our goals and what end states we think are desirable, what we expect to happen or what we expect to do, and so on. But that's okay. I don't think that means that causation as a whole has become pragmatic or that it depends upon our goals or values. There's still an objective core, namely that messy causal model, or what we're representing by the structural equations, sort of the pattern of all possible combinations of antecedent variables in counterfactuals. So the sort of entire complex set of possible counterfactuals. It's only a specific relation of actual causation that is going to be pragmatic in this way and depend upon our goals, desires, and abilities and expectations. So we can have a pragmatic element in our account of actual causation without making causation itself be something that's fully pragmatic and so on. And I am done. Thank you. And thanks for our volunteer.